ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What if living offline isn't a choice anymore? I'm Rae Johnston, and in Opt Out, I'm finding out just how much of our lives are online and whether we can ever really unplug. From privacy experts to hackers, we explore what it means to disappear in a world that's always watching. Opt Out. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to Late Night Live on ABC Radio National Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Those COVID lockdowns are a few years behind us now, but are we who we were before we shut ourselves away for all those months? Did COVID change our lives? Are we more disconnected, perhaps, more individuals and less a society these days? With some great literary minds at this year's Adelaide Writers' Week, I examined the state of the self in 2025. My guests were authors Geraldine Brooks, Rachel Kushner, and Julia Baird. Wonderful to see you all here under the trees on the edge of the parade ground in Adelaide for Adelaide Writers' Week. Now look, yesterday we came to grips in a brisk hour with the state of the nation. And today, the state of the self. What's at issue here, according to the program, is a post-COVID flight from sociability that has left us atomized individuals in a neoliberal world of hyper-individualism, narcissism, and alienation. Now, I don't know what any of that means. Though I've got a bit of a clue about narcissism, which is why I'm here doing this job. But otherwise, they are big words begging for an explanation, which is why I have with me on the stage here Geraldine Brooks, whose books... Woo-hoo! Whose books we adore and visits home we look forward to so keenly... And I doubt there's anybody here under the trees who hasn't read her latest, Memorial Days. And also at the far end of the panel in her attractive moon boot, Julia Baird, writer, broadcaster, biographer. And if you love biography, go and read her biography of Queen Victoria, which she published 7 or 8 years ago. It is beautiful. It's a good biography. She's also a warrior, very bossy, and a profoundly good person. And her latest book, which will be another bestseller, probably already is, is called Bright Shining Thing, How Grace Changes Everything. And closest to me, where I can keep an eye on her, we are most pleased to have back in Adelaide after an absence of only, what, 11 years, is it, Rachel? Yeah, 11 years. And I know this is a bit of a cliche, but she is an acclaimed novelist, Rachel Kushner, whose latest book is Creation Lake, which has sold by the tens of thousands and, amongst other honours, shortlisted for the Booker.
That old thing.
The right book doesn't always win the Booker. Used to, doesn't anymore. Rachel, can I ask for some help from you first up? Because it's such an American word. Alienation. Do you have some kind of grasp of what that means?
Well, I think, you know, people talk a lot about alienation. I don't have an analysis of it, but I think it's a symptom of atomization. And alienation is how people feel when they're atomized. Atomization is what happens when a society loses a sense of collectivities of various forms. So, for instance, church is one form of collectivity. Being part of a culture of volunteering and being part of organizations where you would meet people that you don't normally come into contact with in your daily life is another form of collectivization. And this is a million years ago, but I wasn't an English major. I studied political economies of industrial society as an undergrad at UC Berkeley. And I had this professor named Harold Walensky who wrote a book about atomization in industrial societies. And he figured out this set of metrics whereby in a given culture, in a given nation, let's say the United States, for example, like, the less people are members of labor unions or churches or different kinds of clubs and societies, the more hours, you know, of TV they watch. He wrote this book in the 70s. Now it would be more like the internet. The more atomized they are as a society. And these things matter because the more atomized people are, the less value they see in concepts like social welfare, in pitching in for something that raises the water level for all people, raises all boats. Atomized societies are also the least likely of all societies to produce sudden political change, like in the form of like a revolutionary horizon. And now, thinking about this morning, I realized atomized societies maybe are also places where you suddenly have oligarchy and people are so alienated from one another that no one seems to really care.
Geraldine. That's a really probing question, I know, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, David.
Over to you, Geraldine.
I looked at that paragraph describing what we were supposed to be talking about, and I had exactly the same reaction as you. But
I will try. And incomprehension.
Yes. I think they were getting at something about how are we going to cope with the aftermath of COVID. What did it really do to us? And I think it's impossible to answer that question yet because we're still seeing the reverberations of the experience. But the problem also is I think all of us experienced COVID in different ways. And I think part of the symptoms that remain in a febrile state are the people who during COVID became extremely online and went down rabbit holes of conspiracy theory. And it was a strange thing to experience in the United States rather than in Australia, where you got the sense that the national mythologies of the two countries had provided completely different reactions to it. So the American national mythology is of idealistic people born across the sea in a quest for religious freedom and individual liberty. And so the rugged individual is the defining mythological figure, whereas where the white Australian mythology, the wretched of the earth, tossed up on the fatal shore, and if we weren't in it together, we were going to go down. And so you don't rise by putting your foot in somebody else's face. You chuck a hand back and bring them with you. And in COVID, we were willing to give up a lot of individual freedoms to save lives, whereas in the United States, everybody was bitching and moaning about it, and as a result, more than 1 million people died unnecessarily. That was the excess death count. So
under Trump, I think we should say.
Under Trump, but also I don't think... I would blame him for absolutely, you know... the tick bite I got last week, if I could, because I am a victim of Trump derangement syndrome, but I think it is a rational response to him. But I don't entirely blame him because Americans have been raised, and Rachel can push back on this if she likes, just to think about your own success is your own doing, not to take into account that, you know, the privilege of having a safe place and good roads and clean water comes from collective decision-making. People think they've all done it by themselves.
And of course, one of the aspects of atomization from COVID was and continues to be WFH. You look puzzled.
I do.
It's working from home, madam.
Oh.
Yes. It's become an abbreviation.
I always work from home, so.
It's nothing new. Julia, do you see these symptoms?
I do see these symptoms. I mean, to me, a lot of that description is basically like living with a teenager, to be honest with you. Atomization, alienation, have I produced an alien? And I'm also watching it in their lives as well. But I think the question of COVID is interesting because I think a lot of these trends began before COVID. And the question of our disconnection from each other, we can trace back to the 1970s, you know, the fact that we're not going joining churches in the same way or unions or having those collective, you know, Robert Putnam, bowling alone, it's been discussed often. And so now people talk about this loneliness epidemic and we don't, you know, spend as much time together. But there was this really quite brilliant article, I think, by Derek Thompson in The Atlantic, which spoke about the antisocial century. And it was the idea that we are actually now choosing to be alone. It is a voluntary solitude. When given the option, people want to stay at home. Now, there's a whole bunch of reasons for this. Is it that our devices are depleting us? So therefore, yeah, if any of you are on social media or you're on Instagram, you'll know there's these recurrent memes about people getting cancellation from their friends from going out. It's like, yay, this is my reaction when my friend cancelled on me. And they're like, you know, and they're like dancing around this disco music. And it's like literally celebrated repeatedly on social media the fact that you no longer have to go out anymore. And I thought the insight that actually people are choosing this in all of our free time now, like the amount of time we spend together. So in any given, David, like in any given weekend in America, how many people, how many households do you think would have someone else over, like a party, drinks, some kind of gathering at their house? What percentage would you imagine?
I've no idea.
4% on any given weekend. The amount of time that people are spending on their own is like obviously increased amongst younger people, amongst actually African-American people in the research that's coming from the US. And I think that that intersection of technology is really significant with how it's changed the way we live our lives and this way we are saying that we want to live our lives. And that to me goes really crucially to the question of atomization. Thompson talks about, so we have you have these circles in your life, right? You've got the family circle that teaches you about love. Then you have this intermediate circle of people you bump into down the street. Those are the kind of the quasi-social relations you have, the guy who runs your local shop, the woman who runs the laundry, whatever, the parents at your local school. And then you have the outer circle, which is like tribes and communities. I mean, we can find them online. We can learn loyalty. We can like still engage with that circle of people, but it's that middle circle that we're now missing contact with. And that middle circle is what teaches tolerance. So when I think of alienation, I think of the concept of becoming alien to each other. And you look at the research which shows the huge spike in the number of people who think that their political opponents are not just stupid and they disagree with them, but really bad people and really actually demonic people. I mean, what we heard in the last US election was kind of astonishing, and the number of times the word evil was used to describe opponents. And yet you'll see some people challenging that and going, oh, you know, there's pictures in the Times and the Atlantic and the Free Press all saying, I'm now living in a town with Trump supporters, and guess what? We've got a strong community and we all help out when there's like a flood or there's a hurricane or something bad happens. And it's not really about that. It's, you know, when you're confronted by people in your midst who need help, people are much more likely to give help. But the idea that we even have to reintroduce that idea that people will actually help each other. So I just thought that article was so insightful in explaining some of the political trends, some of the ways that we look at each other with greater suspicion, at the world with greater suspicion. And the people who poll as being more alienated, more discontent, it's not that they're more likely to believe in conspiracy theories, though that too can happen. It's that they're more likely to say they want chaos.
They
want chaos and disruption and the system to be blown up. And that is being played out in electorates around the world, and I think especially in the US.
Rachel.
After I finished writing this recent novel,
Creation Lake, I took an assignment from Harper's Magazine, very old American magazine for which I contribute somewhat regularly. And it was my proposal to them and kind of a huge project where I wanted to write about the past and future of hot rodding in America. I realized that's why a lot of you are actually here, is to hear about that article. And I'm interested in classic cars. And my son, who's 17, was 16 at the time when I wrote the article, is also very interested in classic cars. And starting when he was about 14, I let him work on my classic. And he taught himself basically how to be a mechanic. And he built an engine, every part of it, by himself, and rebuilt his own car. And we started going together to nostalgia drag races, which I realize a lot of you are going off to witness later after this event. But part of it for me was seeing that my son has totally rejected the online world and greatly prefers material life, touching things with your hands. There's this quote I really love by the filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard, which is, "Man is an animal who thinks with his hands." And in so much of life, we've lost that haptic connection. A lot of people buy things, they don't know how they work. When they break, it goes into a landfill and they buy a replacement for it. Mm. And the very idea of the phones and the scrolling is all about a kind of radical dispossession that ironically is being acted upon the wealthier social layers of our society, where you no longer really own things. You own, you stream something, you rent something, you purchase an Uber ride. You know, like, this is not a real form of possession. And what I saw in my son was maybe something that occurred to me was classical possession, which is you own something that you understand and can take apart its inner workings and even denature it to do something new that it wasn't intended to do. So we would go to the racetrack to see these nostalgia races and meet all of the people who were part of this community. And it turns out that drag racing and the National Hot Rod Association is the most diverse sport in America. It includes every age range of people, men and women, because it's assisted competition, so there, men have no advantage in it. Lots and lots of Japanese Americans, African Americans, Filipino people. There's a long history of Latino drag racers. And what I saw was families working together, no one looking at their phone. Everyone completely engaged in this activity that requires knowledge and hand knowledge. And if you were interested in it and had questions for people, there was a sense of total open hospitality. If you were thirsty, there was water. If you were hungry, there was food. If you needed shade, somebody would make a seat for you in their pit area where they were working on their vehicle. And I knew while I was working on this, we spent 8 months doing this together for the article, which came out in December, and it's 12,000 words. It's quite long. And it's really about my relationship with my son, but also I knew that Trump was coming. I knew he was going to win the election. And I wanted to stay close to people in order to see other iterations of care and love that weren't defined by national politics, which in fact is very abstract to many people. In terms of what Geraldine said about, you know, the American character and Trump being some manifestation of that, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that was my summary of that portion of what you said. I thought, you know, maybe it's true. I mean, what do I know? I'm just a novelist. But I feel like the Democratic Party doesn't have a very strong narrative in the way that the Trumpers have a very strong narrative. Their narrative is distortive and gross and false, but it works on people. And the Democratic Party's narrative was, this is the last stop before totalitarianism. And that actually doesn't work on people. You have to give them something positive that they can get behind. And if you look now at who voted for Kamala, it's primarily people who are in the highest earning group and live in coastal cities, either California or New York. The Democratic Party has experienced over the last 40 years very extreme de-alignment by working people. And they have to figure out how to correct for that. I actually believe if we had an electoral system like France, where there was a runoff, the Democratic Party would have died the way that the Socialist Party in France died, because there would be more room for other voices to come in and say, hey, what about Medicare for all, you know? And these issues that do go across the aisle. But we have this two-party system where we're rigidly stuck in it. And now it just seems like the Democratic Party has to figure that out. And I don't know what the future holds.
Rachel, as you were speaking, I've just every now and again glance towards our splendid team of signers. And I have seen things signed that I have never seen before. And I was wondering if our signers could, at my direction, once again sign classic cars. That's the bit I saw. That's the bit. Okay, now while we're at it, could
that's
we...
really good radio, so good. David. Yeah.
Yes. It's top of the line radio. And while we're at it, Trump.
Yes.
Could we sign Trump? It seemed to be an action first of hand washing, and then of touching the coif. Is that? Yeah. That I think was right. We almost got off the topic here, but not quite.
I've completely lost the thread. I'm so intrigued by what you just did.
On ABC Radio National Summer, this is Late Night Live, and you're listening to my conversation with Geraldine Brooks, Rachel Kushner and Julia Baird on the state of the self at the Adelaide Rise Week earlier this year. Geraldine, do you see what Rachel is talking about and what Julia is to some extent as well, about a sense of wanting to blow things up at the moment?
There definitely is, a section of the community who really feels so left out and left behind. And I do date that back to the Clinton administration, when there was a turning away from the base of the Democratic Party. But I also, Kamala didn't lose by much. And yeah. The Republicans make out that they have this overwhelming mandate. It was a tiny sliver. And if you take the misogyny of people who would never vote for a woman and the racism, who would never vote for a black person, out of it, then this is a very evenly divided electorate. And, I've sort of stopped... I think Don Watson put it really well recently. He said, if anybody says they understand what's going on in America, walk away quickly. I have never felt so confounded. Unlike Rachel, I did not think he would win. I couldn't imagine, as I was filling in my own bubbles on the ballot, anybody was bubbling for that guy. So I feel like, for all the, 20 years of somewhat reluctant expatriation in America, I really don't understand that country. So I should probably shut up now.
All right, you can leave the platform. It's okay. Get another coffee. No, you're not going to go away at all. Our fundamental passions never change, do they? We are what we are, the good, the bad, the need, what we need, what we fight for, what we're alive for, it never changes.
I believe that as a historical novelist, it's my fundamental belief that strong emotions have been the same through time.
So has the self changed now, or is the furniture just being rearranged a little?
I tend to think it's the furniture. Love, hate, wanting to see your children live a better life. I don't think that's been any different through history.
Then why has the furniture changed?
Rachel?
Excuse me. Ms. Brooks, I am in charge here. And you will continue this answer for at least a little bit longer. Until, out of pity, I see you have run completely dry. But I'd like you to continue for a little bit longer.
Well, I think I said it. I think, you know, in political terms, the Democratic Party abandoned its working class base. I think they did not push back hard enough against the dismantling of trade unions because there was a takeover of the American Democratic Party by Wall Street interests. Mm-hmm. And when you see where all the money was coming from, it was coming from not the union hall so much anymore as the hedge funds. And I think that the result of that is people just felt that it wasn't their party anymore. And in marched, you know, the brown shirts to tell them, you can identify with us. We get you, even though they don't, even though everything they are doing is counter to the interests of, you know, struggling Americans.
How long is it going to take for them to wake up to that?
Well, that's where I think Don Watson was right, if I could tell you that.
We would all walk away. Yeah. Julia, do the profound passions ever change? The profound needs, what we are, what ourselves fundamentally are, that doesn't change, does it?
No, it doesn't change. I completely agree with Geraldine. What it is to be human is fundamentally the same. We're all a bit broken. We're all trying to muddle our way through, have some purpose, learn how to love. I think that the world and the cultures we live in dramatically change and go through periods where some attributes and some ways of being and some ways of living are valued more highly than others. And, you know, when we're talking about being individuals and what that means, and I think that's an interesting point about Australia having a strong sense of the collective. I think America does have a strong sense of local community, actually. And I went to primary school there, and I always had that strong sense that my town, kind of, we all looked after each other. But there's this fundamental disconnect in the US with no healthcare, like no universal healthcare. And if like 60% of bankruptcies in the US are linked to an illness or a medical problem, like I think that is a fundamentally flawed democracy in terms of that basic sense of caring for each other. So I think that's a big difference. It's going to be another point about the alienation. What was your question again?
I don't have any questions. I'm just passing the ball along the line.
There's a lot of cliched ways people speak about who we are now and how we are now that I think often need interrogation. And people often speak about younger people in certain ways, you know, but it is without denying that empathy is now being cast as a weak and unpopular trait. There's books out in the US called Toxic Empathy now, that's a sense of weakness. And the individualism is interesting when it comes to narcissism too, because Peggy Orenstein cited some interesting research in her book about teenage girls, and she was looking at this data, this study that was done comparing your diaries from girls at the turn of the Victorian century, just before Queen Victoria died in the 1890s, and then to just more than a century later. And in the 1890s, they're all like, I will be kinder to my mother. I will be, you know, do my exercises. I will, like, all these kind of character-forming things. And then 100 years later, it's, I'm going to lose more weight. I'm going to, I don't know, get a glow up. And I think it's an important study, but I also think I'm wary of citing it because we always kind of vilify young women for behaving in certain ways.
And vilify young men for working.
And vilify young men as well. Yeah. But I think it is clear that narcissism is rewarded now in our political leaders, in the people who get the most kind of airtime, the following on social media. And I think that is actually kind of problematic because you create a cult of the self and you're rewarded for it.
Mm. Rachel, from this distance, looking at America, and I don't mean just in the last couple of years, but it's possible to look at America and say, it is such a cruel country.
It is a cruel country.
Why?
Well, it's a cruel place. I remember recently asking my father, who I'm quite close to both my parents, I talk to them all the time, and I have lots of friends who are their generation, people born at the onset of World War II who are now in their 80s, and I want their perspective on things. And I had asked my father about the assassination of JFK because, you know, for many people, this is a defining act. And as Don DeLillo said, it sort of broke the back of the American 20th century. My parents never, ever talked about JFK. And I asked my dad, like, do you remember where you were when JFK was assassinated? And he looked at my mother bewildered, like, no. You know, why? For him, that wasn't a significant moment at all. But he said, I do remember exactly where I was when I found out that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And I said, were you surprised? And he said, no, because that's what this country is. And that is who we are. And it was kind of hard to take that in. When I think now about American character and this idea of cruelty, like I spend a lot of time in France, and my French friends, especially right before the election, really wanted to talk about the American domestic political situation and the prospect of Trump. They care about it for their own reasons geopolitically, but also they're fascinated by a kind of American savagery that's hard to understand from a French perspective, which is a place where people, if I may summarize, do have something like the state inside of them in a way that Americans don't. There's a sense of almost like you are ontologically a citizen of a place, and Americans are not like that. There's a way in which there's a tinge of admiration to the questions about American cruelty and American savagery. I think that it can produce remarkable art. I mean, this is a tangent, but I went last night to see the documentary about the early days of the band Led Zeppelin, and to hear Robert Plant talk about his dream of going to America, of leaving provincial and confining England and its ideas of what's possible in music behind. It was absolutely his dream to come to America, and the Led Zeppelin came. They toured the whole country in 1968, and it was kind of like the chaos that they marinated in and the way that they were able to access a sensibility that comes from black music, from the blues, from the Southern American states, and then borrow aspects of it and transform it into something totally energetic and new and explosive, does have to do with a sort of dialectical American spirit. There are wonderful components of it. There are also really terrible components of it. To this question of like, are human emotions static and timeless? I don't know the answer to that. I am more predisposed to think about the way that history shapes character. And I think recently, yet again, about Manifest Destiny, which was something I thought a lot about in the 1980s as a young person, because my country had overthrown governments in Central America and South America and really ruled their corner of the hemisphere. Now we have basically Elon Musk running our country, and he wants to go to Mars. And I realized, like, we've reached the end of the myth in terms of Western expansion. There's nowhere else to go geographically in terms of moving west. And I think that the Mars Project is a continuation of this myth. You know, people define nostalgia as not a remembrance of a real past that you inhabited and knew and experienced, but a romanticization of something that never was. And I think Manifest Destiny is like that. It's like looking for the new frontier. And if it involves the exploitation of other people, so be it. But in terms of Mars, it's like looking to make America great again by continuing with an expansionist project. And it also seems like right-wing accelerationism, where any idea that there should be limits because of the climate is going to be responded to with full throttle.
Julia.
I just wanted to add to this conversation something that I've really learned from my own research, and something which I've observed a lot in Australia, actually, which is we've spoken about an era of narcissism, and I think all of those things are true. But when I wrote my book, which was about awe and wonder in dark times, when the world goes dark, called Phosphorescence, I really was exploring research around the shrinking self and how wonderful it is to be small and to feel small. And we live in a time where a lot of the, you know, TED Talks around are about occupying space and being big and commanding attention, and like so much extroversion is rewarded. But actually, psychologically, we underestimate the incredible, like, kind of soothing power of being small. Now, when astronauts go up into space, they talk about it like the overview effect. When the Earth disappears, like behind your thumb, like a pea. They go up, they're mathematicians, they're engineers, they're teachers, they come back, they're theologians, they're poets, they're philosophers and philanthropists. They've seen how small the Earth is, how much we need to protect it and each other, how little national boundaries matter. And all the research around smallness is kind of fascinating. People who had gone through for a walk through a grove of Californian redwoods compared to those who had just gone for some boring walk. They never say what the boring walk is, but I assume it's dull. And
it's a eucalyptus grove.
No.
No! Eucalyptus regnans are the most magnificent trees in the world.
Now, I'll get to the eucalyptus
research in a moment. No.
Ladies and gentlemen, please show a little understanding. The exploding blue gums in Los Angeles were devastating in those fires, and the Americans have rethought the eucalyptus a little bit. They'll get over the bitterness because they'll soon, once again, be reminded what a useful tree they are. Rachel?
They toxify the soil when they are an invasive species so that nothing else can grow. So they, I'm from California, and they've destroyed our ecology.
Well, you shouldn't have planted them. Keep going.
I agree. No offense against the eucalyptus. I just couldn't help myself.
Take this woman to Tasmania.
So the group that had been through the redwoods, when they left the park, were more likely to help someone than those who had not. And the experience of awe, which is being stopped in your tracks, marvelling at something like which is much bigger, vaster than yourself, often incomprehensible, that feeling you get when you're sitting on a hill and you're looking up at a big canopy of stars, that feeling that you get when you, when you're like immersed in a vast ocean, like that sensation of awe gives you a shrinking self. And when that happens, you're more likely to feel like, and studies show, more likely to feel like an inhabitant of the earth, more likely to be altruistic and to want to help other people. And I think that's a really interesting thing to contemplate when we're thinking about what is the state of the self. There was one study of awe walks, and they got about 60 people, and they went over like a 6-week period, I think it was, might have been slightly longer. And they got, again, some people went on a boring walk. These guys went on an awe walk, paying attention to their surroundings, writing a journal about it and taking a photograph. At the beginning of this experiment, their faces were quite big in the photo. They're like, meh, here I am on my first awe walk, and then doing it again and again. By the end of the study, their faces were forming a smaller part of the frame because they were like, hey, look behind me at this tree that's just burst into bloom. Oh, wait, I just managed to capture this bird. Oh, check out this sunset. They are shifting the focus from themselves to the outside world, paying attention to the world that we live in, listening to country. They are paying attention to the suffering around them, to the things that other people need. When we talk about that antisocial century, one thing that really troubled me in that article was that of between the early 2000s and 2023, this is back to the US again, the number of people that left the home to care for someone other than in your own nuclear family, to just care for other people, had dropped by a third. And that to me is something that's a problem when we think about the self, because the self for a lot of us is about helping other people and looking after other people and looking after the earth and all that kind of stuff. So I think that the pursuit of awe, and that's why so many people hunger for it and want to talk about it, we share it. It's not, I mean, some people don't like sunsets and whales, that's fine. but generally, that's something we share and can experience together, no matter who you are or what you do or what you think or how crazy your ideas are. And I think that's a really kind of leveling and important thing at a time when we're told to gaze into flickering devices and post little frames of our face. I think actually shifting focus away from the self is huge.
Geraldine, you've just written a book about awe and nature and grieving. Mm. How do they fit together?
I lost my husband suddenly, unexpectedly, and I was not right in the head, as you are not when you have a huge loss like that. And you expect, I think, to be cracked for about a year, and I was still cracked 3 years later. And at that point, I thought, I have to do something about this. I have to stop acting the role of woman being normal and actually try and recapture normality. And I, since my early 20s, when I was an environment reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald, a job I got more or less by accident, because when I joined the paper, the environment reporter was aging and corpulent, and when an issue required backcountry snow camping or rafting down the Franklin River, he wasn't up to it. And strictly speaking, as a girl who'd grown up in a family where, as Woody Allen said, we were two with nature. my parents never went outside, basically. It was news to me that wilderness existed and that it was so incredibly powerful. And my experience, particularly on the Franklin, being in a place where nature is so big and you are so small, just cracked open my soul in a way, you know, that was just the greatest gift. And so when I came to this recognition that I needed to do something drastic, it was all about going into nature for the healing power that could provide.
But it was also about being alone, wasn't it?
Well, I needed to get away from all the things, even the beloved things, that filled my head and hadn't let me do the work of grieving that I needed to do. So I had to leave my kids and my animals. And, you know, it was 3 years later, I hasten to say, I would never have done what Peter Matheson did in The Snow Leopard, abandoned his kid and just went off to do his own grieving work. They were getting on with their lives, and I felt that I could have the immense privilege of taking this time and space. And it was just me and memories of Tony and nature. And I think it worked.
Well, time will tell, of course. We recently had on Late Night Live a discussion about Antarctic tourism. And once again, reported from that was that, well, there are certain dangers to Antarctic tourism, because now over 100,000 people a year are going down into that extraordinary place. But people were better for it. But my question was, I think I might have forgotten to ask it at the time, how long does it last? Now, Julia, has it lasted for you? Oh, I mean, you've experienced all, and now some years later, you're still a better person for it.
Yeah, it's fundamentally changed my life. In really kind of deep and mysterious ways. And the reason I started to write about it is because I was lifted up in ways I couldn't quite understand how. I mean, this was after I'd been diagnosed with cancer, and it was a really dark, really dark time. But I was sustained in a way by, a lot of it was ocean swimming for me, which has just brought such a magic and beauty to my life, and the sense of smallness on the edge of the vast, you know, sea. And like just last week I swam with a turtle. It just went bloop up under me, and I was like, you know what, I'm just going to swim with this turtle for half an hour. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to watch it going in and out of the reef, up and down, scooting across the way it paddles. They just paddle so efficiently, turtles. But if you see them at Ningaloo, they're like these big drunken uncles at a buffet. They're like smashing around and eating the reef. I couldn't quite get over that. They were really like busting this reef up. Anyway, I'm digressing. So, yeah, so I really was trying to fathom that. Honestly, it was like, how has this had such an impact on me? And I think wonder can do that as well. There's a wonderful book called The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. And
excuse me, could we have that title again? I can see people reaching for their pens.
I think it's The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. And it's a woman who was really sick and, like, confined to her bed for a good period, a couple of years, and I don't know how long it went, but there was a good period of intensity. And someone brought her a plant, and so they didn't realize it had a snail on it. And every day she watched this snail, and then she learnt, and then she would kind of look up and facts about it, and she suddenly it had babies one day and she didn't know, and she was observing it going up and down. Sounds really boring. It is one of the best pieces of natural, like, science writing I've ever read. And that sense of, like, I did not know it, but there was a snail that got me through this period of my life. And I was a bit like that with cuttlefish. So what I then decided to do was, like, to say, because cuttlefish swim in my local bay, was to go, I'm not just going to treat this as an incidental thing. Like, you know, it's great to see the sunrise or sunset. It's good to see, you know, beautiful things on your walk to work. You might go away to holiday somewhere nice, but I'll be like, I am going to hunt this. I'm going to, like, make sure. It's another dimension of my life, my physical health, my mental health, and then there's, like, the awe stuff, which I just know that I need and I know that fuels me. And I've tried to take my kids along on that ride as well. And it's definitely given me a level of contentment, I think.
Rachel?
Yeah.
Have you ever experienced anything like this?
Well, yes, but I think that it's wonderful to imagine you swimming in the ocean with the turtles, and I can see that it would produce, you know, what you described as a profound change in your life. And at listening to you, I was thinking, you know, I haven't gone to Antarctica. I don't seek out sort of natural wonders, you know, with a capital W, but I don't feel like personally I need to, because I know that the world is a very blessed place, and that human life is an incredible gift that I'm living every day. And I don't smoke marijuana. I take small puffs of joy every day. And I access that joy in part through modest versions of nature. I'm really interested in native plants, which is maybe, you know, I'm sorry if I offended anybody with my mention of the eucalyptus, but...
But you did offend, and I'm not sure that your apologies are going to be... Look.
Well, just let me talk, and then they'll decide.
Yeah. Oh, that's what they say to all radio presenters. Go on.
I've been gardening with native plants for decades now, and I've seen when you plant what was naturally sort of one ecosystem, just reproduced on a very small plot. I just have a little garden in front of my house. It changes entirely who comes in terms of birds and butterflies, all kinds of fauna. And now I see that the kind of gardening design plants that just could come from anywhere, that are placed there for their color, produce a kind of sterility. And I'm awed that I get monarch butterflies in my garden. All I have to do is go outside to feel a sense of wonder. I also just spent the last 6 years writing this novel that is really built on a thematic about the question of how we proceed given our knowledge that life is blessed and that there's some kind of wonderful import and grace to what my character Bruno thinks of as the human project. And he has a long kind of disquisition late in the book about cosmology and the fact that, you know, for 9/10 of human time on Earth, people looked up in order to orient themselves, and what they saw, depending on where they were in terms of northern or southern hemisphere, was the same as what other people saw. And the whole idea of cosmology bending toward things like astrology, even if that's not, you know, your thing, is the idea that we can divinate our future in the common. Now in our society, there are a lot of people on Earth who have never seen the Milky Way and will never see the Milky Way. Mm. And that saddens me, and I become somebody who, you know, has strong feelings about light pollution. And I don't know what the solution is, but I think that people have to find small forms of wonder that connect them one person to the next. In Los Angeles, I work with a group called Tree People, And we replant native habitat in burn scars. The work is obviously just expanded significantly. None of that can begin anytime soon because it's not safe yet. But when you work to garden on a plot that you don't own, that's just out there somewhere in the county, it's even more pleasurable than gardening at home. Mm.
Do you have a plant on your desk as you write?
No, I just go outside to my garden.
Julia, do you have a plant?
No, I've got one just outside my window though.
That you can keep an eye on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you?
No, because I live on the several trees. Acres of, yeah. of land, and why would I bring it inside?
I find they're very good company. Except my partner keeps taking it back out and putting it in the garden.
Well, you know, you live with somebody who really understands plants, which is fantastic. But I just want to say that I loved what Rachel said, because we can get so overwhelmed by our predicament in this moment. And I love the idea of doing the thing that falls under your hand to do. Yeah. And in the act of restoring your patch of ground, if we could all just do those small things together, they are going to be a huge part of the solution.
Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that deals with atomization. Now, we've only got 4 minutes left, but could we have a look at neoliberal world of hyper-individualism and alienation? Though we have a bit along the way, haven't we?
We have, yeah.
And I didn't get to ask the really important question, was whether ourselves changed with the invention of the telephone, because that was the moment where we didn't have to be with somebody to communicate to them. And then I've got a theory on this, and it's led to...
These 4 minutes are yours, David.
It's led to the internet, and then it's led to working from home, and then we just don't have to see anybody anymore.
Yes. I think also the iPhone has been part of that. Computers?
Yes.
Trajectory, yes.
We don't actually have to talk to anybody anymore.
Yeah.
But do you remember when, if you didn't know something, then you just didn't know it?
Yes.
Unless, of course, a salesman had sold as a salesman had sold my parents a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
And you went and had a look in that.
We had to go to the library.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a friend explaining to her kid the other day that in the old days, if you wanted to see a picture, know what a unicorn was or see a picture, you'd have to get in the car, drive to the library, go to a section, look up a book. It's wild.
Luxury. We had to take the bus.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, these three writers will be over there signing copies of their books. They will offer, in a rationed form, actual human communication face-to-face. And we can once again celebrate the fact that here at the Adelaide Writers' Festival, we know how to communicate with one another because we turn out in vast crowds to see people face-to-face. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's the show. On our next... The history of that great Australian feminist publishing house, McPhee Gribble, plus the lure of the beach shack. ¶¶